Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Fourth generation Chico and Kate Washington wrote a book about caring for her husband when he was recovering from a medical crisis that temporarily left him unable to see, walk, or eat. After the publication of her memoir, Already Toast, Caregiving and Burnout in America, Kate Washington has been a frequent speaker about her experience as a caregiver. As she approached her 50th birthday, she wanted to end her 23-year marriage and dunk herself in 50 different bodies of water. Her new memoir, Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims, offers a fresh vision of midlife to women who have abandoned themselves in service of others. Kate Washington will be at the bookstore on Main Street in Chico on July 23rd. Kate Washington, bienvenue.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I have to admit, the reason I welcomed you in French was I would like to go back to your first big solo adventure.
Absolutely.
So what was that in the summer of 1988?
So in the summer of 1988, I had just finished my sophomore year at Chico High, and I was taking French and really enjoyed the language, loved the country. I'd actually traveled there before as a child. My grandparents had taken me on a big trip there, but it was with them. And that summer, I went on a language program study abroad with a homestay with a family in Brittany. And I think I was gone for 6 or 7 weeks. And of course, in those days, you could travel abroad, but the idea that you might make long distance calls home was almost unthinkable because it was so expensive. And so I had letters from home. I was quite homesick, but it was a really exciting trip abroad. It really improved my French a lot, though it's not as good as it was back then. Now, and it was a real moment of independence for me.
Well, I'd like to fast forward 34 years.
Certainly.
What took you back to France 34 years later?
So I actually went back to France in the fall of 2022, very shortly before my 50th birthday, just a month before, to speak about caregiving. As you noted in your introduction, I wrote a book about caregiving, and I was invited to speak at an oncology conference in Paris on a panel that was from the point of view of patients, caregivers, nurses. It was trying to give kind of a more holistic view of cancer care. And I was invited, and they told me they'd put me up in Paris and they'd fly me over. And I'd never said yes to an invitation so quickly because it was such a great opportunity. And it was also a kind of a challenging time. You know, my older daughter was starting her senior year of high school. I was fairly freshly separated from my husband. So I had to work some things out to get there. But I did also tack on an extra trip down to the south of France, where I knew there were some places I wanted to swim as part of that 50 Dunks Challenge that you also mentioned in the introduction, one of which was my second to last swim, and it was in the shadow of a Roman aqueduct that was absolutely beautiful, like being able to swim underneath that. So it was a real, almost a baptism as like a new kind of solo travel in a very different phase of my life than that first travel in the late 80s.
And since you mentioned your husband, he didn't have any trouble with French because he was bilingual.
That's true. He grew up in Canada and was educated in a bilingual setting in Ottawa. So he was fluent in French.
Well, one reason I wanted to bring up this situation of your going to France when you were quite young, summer of 1988, and then 34 years later, because I think what you expressed about your level of competence, if I want to say it that way, in French, is an example of your life and my life in that at first, oh, I don't want to make a mistake. What's the conjugation of that verb? Did I say that verb right? And then with the passage of time, you aren't afraid of making mistakes. You just go ahead and speak it and don't worry about whether you're making mistakes. And I think that's kind of the way your life evolved. Am I making sense, Kate?
Absolutely. And I think actually that's a really astute insight and one I hadn't thought of related to the broader arc. But, you know, it is true that when you're a teenager, or, you know, for me, much longer than teenagerhood, you're worried about what people might think and whether, you know, how you're going to be perceived. And it's so freeing to just let go and say, like, you know, I'm going to bumble along a little bit. I might make a mistake. There's a scene in my book where I go into a gas station. I'm trying to like figure out how to put gas in the car in French. And for anyone who knows French, the number system above like 60 is confusing. And the lady in this like tiny town in Provence is like staring at me like, what are you talking about, ma'am? But I worked it out and it ended up being kind of empowering. And you know, traveling solo like that and being on my own and renting a car and being in the back roads of France and having the freedom to both make mistakes, but to have the experiences I wanted to have and that really were exciting and fun and interesting for me was a real shift in a lot of ways in how I'd lived my life up to that point. You know, I did a lot of things always trying to do the right thing and get on to the next stage. And, you know, not to say it wasn't a good life. It has been a wonderful life in many, many ways. But turning a little bit more towards myself and what I wanted is something that I think a lot of women at midlife in particular find ourselves looking around and thinking like, where have I gone in the last, you know, 20, 30 years of caring for other people, of being engaged in building a career, building a life, building a family, all of the things that have to be done. And then you look around, it's like, what's left of me? And this book, in a lot of ways, is about getting back to myself and to the kid I was growing up in Chico, really.
Well, since you mentioned traveling in France and you were by yourself, and oh, that was a real nail biter when you're trying to put gas in your car and running out of gas. But were you comfortable dining alone in France?
Yes, I was. I really enjoy it, actually. I also spend a long time as a restaurant critic, and so I've done a lot of dining out in my time, and usually with a meal for being a restaurant critic, I would take a companion or two, but I really like dining alone. It's a lot of fun. You get to look around, get to eavesdrop. For me, especially in France, it meant, you know, practicing listening and trying to understand and keep up with, you know, the quick talk, because that's often a point where, you know, I can say something and then somebody responds in rapid fire French and I'm like deer in the headlights. But I really enjoy it. It gives me just a chance to be with myself and be in the moment experiencing the meal. And in some ways, swimming does the same thing for me. You know, I undertook a lot of these expeditions alone, and you can't really be planning ahead or thinking about the past or being anxious or worried about the future when you're underwater. You're just underwater and you're in that moment. And that was a real lesson for me, but also a real pleasure to just live in the moment, which is something that sometimes I struggle to do as somebody who's a little bit type A and planning oriented.
Yeah, you were, in fact, the food critic for the Sacramento Bee. You became the food critic in 2017, which is where your residence now. Let me remind listeners that the title of your book is Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims. The author is Kate Washington. So I want to go back to how you happened to grow up in Chico, because I mentioned that four generations of your family were here in Chico. So where did let's say your paternal grandfather, where was he from?
He was actually from Kansas, and he came to Kansas to work livestock on a ranch in, I believe, the 30s. But my paternal grandmother was born and raised in Chico. She was born in 1909 in Chico, went to Chico High, eventually became a teacher at Chico High and met my grandfather, and they married and raised my dad there.
And it's interesting, too, that your grandfather's name was George Washington. But I can see why your dad would go by his middle name, Ernest, instead of George Washington. Now, your paternal grandfather, George Washington, started out raising sheep and cattle, but then he switched to almonds, walnuts, and rice. So
just almonds, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't raise walnuts or rice.
Oh, okay.
He has an almond orchard, but he had an almond orchard acreage south of town.
So you grew up here, and you then go off to, your family goes to Berkeley. But I would like you to read a section in your book. Well, you didn't go to Berkeley. You chose to, where did you go?
Well, let me, shall I just read the, read the passage that
read
reveals
what you said about
certainly.
That.
Yeah, because my parents met at Berkeley, a couple of my grandparents met at Berkeley, et cetera. As I got older, doing what my elders liked turned into a lot of conventional choices that sometimes had the tiniest of rebellious streaks. For college, I rejected the family tradition of Berkeley in favor of a big East Coast private school, Georgetown, though I now think the lefty ferment of Berkeley would have suited me far better. My disappointed grandfather consoled himself with the fact that Georgetown was Catholic, though I was not religious and had no intention of becoming so. I dated nice boys and introduced them to my family. I returned to California and chased prestige in a PhD program and got married to another nice boy. In all this outward success, I failed to explore myself or to understand my own desires or to live according to what I thought I valued. My feminism and socialist beliefs clashed with my need for approval, so I channeled them into writing papers about feminism, class, and sexuality in Victorian literature, getting an advanced degree for my trouble. Keeping my explorations theoretical rather than actual felt like having my cake and eating it too. And I should say, ending there, that the graduate school I went to was Stanford, so that was another departure from family tradition that disappointed. The grandfather mentioned in that passage is my maternal grandfather, actually. But yeah, they were like, well, Stanford's good, but Cal? but they didn't let me in for graduate school. So.
My guest was reading from her book, Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims, and the author is Kate Washington. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Kate Washington, who has written a book entitled Midstream. So, how did you meet your husband?
We met in graduate school in that PhD program. I started in the fall of 1994, and he started there the following year, and we met and got together in early 1996. So, I was 23 when we met. I was 21 when I started that graduate program, so quite young. And I was a Victorianist. He was a modernist studying Joyce and other modernist authors. And we fairly quickly moved in together and got married a few years later.
Well, I was quite interested in the word you used when you're saying that, we were maybe getting married, talking about getting married at your insistence, and we were having a day when I wheedled him for a ring. Kate, that surprised me.
Looking back, it surprises me too, but I think that I think I was always looking ahead to the next stage, to ambition, to wanting to settle down, to wanting, the kind of outward markers of success. And to my mind, even though I was studying marriage as it was represented in literature and studying kind of feminist theory, marriage and eventually children, which I knew I wanted to have and did, were kind of markers of those next stages of adulthood. I was, trying to grow up and show, that I had made it as an adult.
You say that you and Brad went to this thrift store, you mentioned 1998, and maybe getting married. And so this engagement ring was not a big flashy one, was it?
No. I remember actually at one point a friend kind of looked down and peered at it and was like, where's the ring? It was a tiny little gold band and it cost $65 at that thrift shop, a little vintage gold band. I was actually very fond of it. I loved that ring.
Well, I remembered then when my husband and I got married and we had each a gold band, and his gold band is lying in the ocean. We went snorkeling in John Pennekamp State Park, which is in Florida. And we went in, we were holding hands, and we went in, he had his ring on. When we got out, his ring was not on his finger anymore. Mm. So you now, where is your ring?
Somewhere in my house. I do not know. I used to keep it. I actually used to hang it when I was going to garden or, go to the gym or something. I had a little Orient and Flume paperweight in the shape of a bear that always has sat on my desk. It was a high school graduation gift from dear family friends in Chico. And its snout was just the right shape for putting a ring on. So that's where I would hold it. And after my husband and I separated, I one day hung the ring there. And a few days or weeks later, I looked over and the ring was not there, and I have never found it since, and I'm not really sure what happened to it. I actually wish I still had it, and a funny story about ring loss, actually, my former husband, when I was pregnant with our first child, we went on a tree cutting expedition up to Butte Meadows in the snow with my family, and, my dad is a kind of like, the best tree is always over the next ridge kind of guy. That's kind of our family thing, and Brad was waiting near the car in the snow. He hadn't worn great shoes and looked down and his ring was gone. And then my brother actually found it in the snow by the side of the car. So it was almost lost and then recovered. But I think he did eventually lose that one again. And we got another one for him. But that was many, many years ago.
So all this sounds romantic. You're getting a ring, you get engaged, you get married, but then comes a day. And this is actually at the beginning of your book, you tell us what happened. I'd like for you to read the passage in your book. This is the start of chapter 2, where you had just had a kind of a fight in your car with your daughters. So would you read what you said to Brad?
Yes, this is many, many years later. So this scene takes place in 2021 and says, I think we should try a trial separation, I said in response to Brad's attempt to relitigate our car fight. His pale face turned a shade more ashen. What would that mean? He said, you want me to move out? Yes, I said. I can't, he said. Where would I go? I'll help you find a place, but I can't keep doing this. His shock shocked me in turn. How, I wondered, could he not have known? I'd brought up the idea of separating in endless couples counseling sessions, told him over and over the marriage wasn't working for me, begged him to hear me. Apparently, he hadn't. What if I find an office to rent so I'm gone during the day for writing, he asked. Since his disability retirement from his work as a professor, we were both home all day, and he argued that more space from each other could solve our problems and my near constant irritation. I think we need to save that money to pay for living space for you, I replied. The money aside, I didn't think an office would solve anything about our marriage. Our house was plenty big. We saw each other little and interacted less. That was part of the problem. I was lonely in my own home, despite being married to the person I ought to have been closest to, but with whom I no longer felt intimacy. Still, I knew him well enough to see how frightened and resistant he was.
This is my guest, Kate Washington. She is just reading from Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims. So you mentioned going to counseling, couples counseling sessions. And I have a friend who has done it. She's mostly retired now, but did that and does it for a living. And I asked her about if she did couples counseling. And she says often by the time the couple comes in, they're pretty much already decided to get a divorce. And so your counseling sessions really didn't save your marriage.
No. And, you know, we saw many counselors. It took me a long time to come to terms with the idea that I was no longer wanting to remain in this marriage. And it was really hard to confront. You know, I didn't want to hurt him. I didn't want to hurt our daughters who'd been through a great deal with the ordeal of their dad's illness. And he had, of course, been through so much. I should say by the time I was kind of coming to this idea, he was no longer blind. He was able to live independently, but it was frightening, I know, for him, and, you know, painful for him to feel like our marriage had changed so much over the course of his illness and my caregiving. It really changed our dynamics tremendously. So this scene and this time when I'm kind of coming to terms with this idea is about 5 years after the major, major crisis of his illness and 6 or 7 years after his diagnosis. So he wasn't in the throes of intense sickness anymore, but he was no longer able to work. He was immune compromised and had some chronic illness that he still contends with, though he's doing quite well. And, you know, his health is stable, I'm happy to say. And we have an amicable relationship, you know, share parenting with our daughters. And it has all been for the best, which is part of, you know, what the book is about. But it was a very difficult decision. And I think, you know, I was hoping we could turn things around in couples counseling, but I think I'd already known by the time we went to see the various counselors that we saw, because it wasn't just one, that it was not really working for me.
Well, another question I had for my retired therapist who counsels, she's a marriage and family therapist, was what you mentioned in your book. You mentioned some percentages according to a 2015 study. And my friend said, yeah, she said that sounded right to her. I'd like for you to read that section in your book where you say that it's women who want to get divorced. Would you read that section in your book?
Certainly. Despite those lingering qualms, I was not only increasingly admitting to myself that I wanted to end my marriage, but starting to believe that a large part of the problem was marriage itself. I was far from alone. According to a 2015 study, women initiate nearly 70% of divorces in heterosexual marriages, a number that rises to 90% when the women are college educated. It's not just that women are dissatisfied in relationships with men. As the author of the study, Michael Rosenfeld, said, I assumed, and I think other scholars assumed, that women's role in breakup was an essential attribute of heterosexual relationships. But it turns out that women's role in initiating breakups is unique to heterosexual marriage. He posits that marriage is more oppressive than non-marital heterosexual relationships. Marriage as an institution has been a little bit slow to catch up with expectations for gender equality, end quote. I would argue that it hasn't just been slow. Rather, it's impossible for marriage to become egalitarian because it is an instrument of patriarchy. I, of all people, should have known that going in. I wrote my doctoral dissertation about marriage in Victorian Britain when the legal doctrine of coverture still held, meaning that a married woman's legal identity was subsumed under that of her husband. When married women could not own property but could be abused and raped by their husbands at will, and when divorce required a literal act of parliament. Why exactly was I so eager to marry as a young feminist in the 1990s, when the backlash against women's rights that runs rampant today was beginning to ferment? Somehow, I didn't connect that history to my own marriage on the cusp of the new millennium. After all, I kept my name, and if anyone asked, Brad would have said he was a feminist. Wouldn't that be enough?
This is my guest, Kate Washington. She grew up in Chico, and she has written a book, Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims. Now, we haven't really gotten to this 50. Why 50? Why 50, Kate?
Well, you know, I always loved swimming in the water and just being in pools, natural bodies of water, anywhere that I could get in and swim, and spent a lot of my childhood in the water. And when I was kind of starting to approach my 50th birthday, so when I was, you know, 48 and a half, and that coincided with the pandemic restrictions ending, with vaccinations coming, and with being able to be out and seeing people and going places more and more, I was just so unhappy with my life, as we've just been talking about, and felt really hemmed in and really constrained. And this also came on the heels of, you know, the summer of 2020 with the Lightning Complex fires, when all of Northern California was just like sunk in smoke for weeks and you couldn't even leave the house really, or much less get any kind of exercise because of the air quality. And I was like, I don't want to face a milestone birthday. I'm not happy with the place my life is in, but I also couldn't figure out really how to change it or what to do. And I thought, I want to do something to mark my 50th birthday. When I turned 40, I'd thrown a big party and had a great time, but I didn't feel like I was going to want a party. And it was still a ways off from my birthday. But I thought, what can I do? And I thought, what if I have a goal of doing something big that would mark 50, but would be just for me and just something I would enjoy? And I loved and still love getting out in nature so much. And I thought, what if I tried to go to 50 different swimming holes? I'd always loved going to swimming holes, but I hadn't had that much time for it when, you know, raising kids and doing really intense caregiving. And, you know, sometimes I would take my kids on outings and things, but I thought, what if I go to 50 places just to get in the water? And I actually called it the 50 dunks rather than 50 swims, because some of the creeks and places I went were so small that it was just a matter of lying down and getting my head under the water. And that's what I called the dunk. But some were bigger swims, some were ambitious, some were close to home. You know, I live very close to the American River in Sacramento, so I went there. I went to places in Chico, like to all of Chico's great places to swim, up in the mountains above Chico, all around Northern California, and then farther afield when I traveled. And when I chose that goal, it was really kind of a whim and just like, oh, 50, that's a big round number. That'll be, you know, that's doable, but I'll have to push myself and have to, you know, get to places. And it turned out to be a much more profound experience along the way than I really realized going in.
Well, there's one huge event in your life that I haven't asked you about yet, and you've mentioned your parents, mm-hmm. that your dad still lives in Chico, but what happened to your mother was just, it was heartbreaking. And would you mind, Kate, would you mind reading what happened? This is 2010. When your mother, she's only 64 years old, and what happened? Would you read that section in your book?
Yes, I will. I'll frame this first by saying that right after I graduated from high school, my mom moved away from Chico. My parents had divorced, and she moved to the Sacramento area. So when I moved back to Sacramento later, she was local to me. And in 2010, I had my two daughters. My older daughter was 4 and a half, and my younger was 6 months old. And my mother was bipolar and had gone into an episode that was very, very difficult for her and for all of us. And so that's kind of the setting for what happened. My feelings about February got more complicated in 2010 when my mother, aged 64 and in the grips of a deep depressive episode, swallowed a lethal handful of medications. My brother and I think she did it on February 21st, a Sunday. She had been to church, the last place anyone saw her. Her phone buzzed a busy signal that evening. She never had call waiting. She thought it was rude. By Monday morning, though, the phone rang and rang. My brother later reasoned that she'd left the cordless handset off the hook so that it seemed she was on the phone and its batteries died. That Monday was one of those bright fall spring days marred by underlying worry. Pete thought she just wasn't answering. I wasn't so sure. A few weeks before, she had told her therapist she was planning to end her life. She would hang herself, she told him, and send me an email just before. Later, she told me she might not reach out to me. I had just gotten my first smartphone, and I responded to email too fast. She didn't want me to save her. Pete and I made a schedule of wellness checks to call her morning and evening. I wrote the number of the suicide hotline in Sharpie and taped it above her desk. She promised she wouldn't take her life. It was the only promise to me that she ever broke.
This is Kate Washington. She grew up in Chico, and she has written a book, Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims. And sadly, we learn later that your mother, you had an aunt in Seattle that also took her life.
Yes.
But you said, Jill, she overdosed with pain medications. So this it's just heartbreaking that your mother took her own life like that. And you say it was the only promise to me she ever broke.
Yeah, she was a very, she was a woman of a great deal of integrity and very honest. And she kept her promises, but she was in too much pain to keep that one.
Well, you still, you have this project of dunking yourself, because you can't really swim in some of these bodies of water, dunking yourself 50 times, and it's part of a reawakening to get back into your body. And I'm just thinking that a lot of us, we live in our heads so much of the time. And you, in your book, give some information about how beneficial it is to dunk ourselves in cold water. And this came as a surprise because I can't say that dunking myself in cold water is appealing. But what are the advantages? You want to look in your book and tell us this, what they found out when they studied cold water dunking?
Sure. I'll also say that, there's a lot of evidence-based, support and evidence for just the idea that getting out in nature is beneficial to our nervous systems, resetting after, stress, chronic stress, but cold water in particular, and not everywhere I went was super cold. I even went to a few hot springs, since by virtue of the fact that I was going out in the Sierra Nevada, a lot of the water was just cold by default because that's how our water is in Northern California. So I'll read the passage now. It's no accident that I felt most like myself and best in the water. Science now shows that cold water plunges increase dopamine, reduce fatigue, and improve well-being. Physician Mark Harper's Chill, The Cold Water Swim Cure, one of many recent books about cold plunges and wild swimming, suggests cold water swimming as a therapy for a host of ailments and surveys the physiology of its effectiveness, from vasoconstriction in the skin to its engagement of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems.
Yeah, thank you for reading this. I think you also mentioned this, getting out in nature is so healthy. But you say science now shows that cold water plunges increase dopamine, reduce fatigue, and improve well-being. So I think that would be a motivation for a lot of us to reconsider maybe the New Year's, the plunge that people jump into the pond here. At 1 mile, and 1 mile here in Chico.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was not one of my 50 swims, but I have since done the New Year's polar bear swim across 1 mile since the timeline of this book ended. So,
well, there's another thing that you did that I think people who own dogs would find, yes, dogs are therapeutic. Even if they aren't trained as therapy dogs, they are therapeutic. So how did you happen to get a dog? You travel off on your adventures, dipping yourself in water. How did you happen to get a dog?
Well, she's very much a Chico dog and was part of an accidental litter. Shortly before my 50th birthday, so in the summer of 2022, my dad and stepmom, my dad has a Springer Spaniel. My stepbrother has an Australian cattle dog who is a young purebred. And these two dogs produced an accidental litter of very, very cute puppies. And my family, my daughters, we'd always had cats. My former husband really preferred cats, did not want a dog.
Kate, but you say in your book, we'd always been a cat family, mainly because Brad disliked dogs. Is that still true? I mean, all along I thought, yeah, Brad was a nice guy, but then, oh my goodness, if he didn't like dogs.
Well, everyone to each their own, I guess. I mean, I grew up with a dog and then later a cat. And so I'd actually kind of forgotten how much work dogs were, and you don't really know how much work dogs are when you're a kid. And then I got a puppy, but it was part of this like big change, all these changes that I was doing. So I kind of was like, oh, this puppy's so cute. But also I knew the temperaments of the parent dogs and thought like, oh, I definitely want a dog, and like thought a companion for these hikes and some of these solo expeditions that I do would also be good for safety as a woman alone out in the mountains. Turns out my dog is incredibly friendly, and while I'm sure she would defend me, it's never come to that, but she mostly approaches strangers with a spirit of wanting to make a new friend, not to protect me. But I got this puppy. My stepmom had raised them in their backyard in Chico, and I took my daughters to meet the puppies. They were so cute, and they were like white with big black splotches. And then my dog has since grown into having like a coat with that looks more like a cattle dog, like kind of salt and pepper. Brad, it is still true. I don't think he likes dogs very much, though he's been around my dog and is kind to her and is, you know, and actually his new partner has a dog. So he's ending up with a dog anyway.
After a break, Kate Washington and I will continue our conversation. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, memoirist Kate Washington. Her new book is Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims. You have all these adventures. You go out and find these places, and they're not always easy to find. Sometimes you have to do a lot of hiking to get there. So now you've got these two young daughters, and wouldn't it be nice if they said, yeah, Mom, we want to jump in that cold water with you.
Mm-hmm.
And was that the case?
Sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. I took them along on many of my adventures, and I'd taken them out to places, you know, since they were young, to the best of my ability. You know, it was tough when they were younger. When Brad was diagnosed with his cancer, they were 9 and 5 years old. So it really constrained a lot of their childhood, the how sick he was. There were periods when he was hospitalized for months on end. You know, and so I had always wanted to have a more, you know, outdoorsy time with them when they were kids, but it was sometimes difficult to do that. Though my older daughter was in a girls' adventure club with one of her best friends, and the best friend's mom had started it. She was a former outdoor educator, so my daughter had spent quite a bit of time, you know, camping, and I'd been able to tag along on some of these. My younger one had been able to tag along on some of these. And over the course of this 50 Dunks project, the girls also really got used to me sometimes just pulling the car over and being like, I'm going in that river. Do you want to come with me? And sometimes they would, sometimes they would wait in the car. Over time, they started coming with me more and more. And there was a moment kind of late in the 50 Dunks project where I was with my older daughter at a really cold creek, and she was hesitating whether to go in. She just kind of come along on the adventure of it. I will also say that their interest in accompanying me was usually inversely proportional to the length of the hike required. But this one had no hike. And my daughter was standing there and saying, like, I don't know whether to go in. It looks really cold. And then she looked at me and she said, but I've never seen you come out of the water without a smile on your face. And then she went in. And it was such a moment for me. She was 17 at the time. She was starting her senior year of high school, so they weren't so young anymore. And it was really a moment where I felt this recognition of me, not just as mom, but as a person and as, you know, somebody who was modeling joy and doing what you loved and following what you want to my kids, which is what I want them to do and how I want them to live. And I've definitely been very imperfect with that and very imperfect in a lot of other ways as a parent. But that has been, I think, a nice thing for us. And it's something they came with me on the 50th swim on my 50th birthday, and they've come on many swims and adventures since. And just yesterday, my daughter was out for a run. We were out in a kind of remote place, and
is she the one that's a rower?
They're actually both rowers. Yes, she was the first one because she's the older, and she now coaches rowing, and she does a lot of dunks when she goes to regattas and to competitions and things like that. But I passed by her and she's like, I'm so hot from this run. Like, do you want to go in the creek? And so, you know, she's like, I think I'm going to dunk in cold creeks, but it was really nice. So it has kind of come around with them.
Do you know, I underlined that sentence in your book where your daughter says, I've never seen you come out of the water without a smile on your face. I thought, oh gosh, that is so sweet. And I think people should maybe consider what it is they do in their life that makes them smile. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of women are like you were, you know, other people's needs come first. Your husband's need came first. And for example, when your husband's mother died in Canada, mm-hmm. then you had to postpone some surgery that you had planned or cancel, postpone. And even when your daughters first learned that you were going to get divorced, it seemed to me like they were kind of blaming you and they were not happy with what you had done to their dad. Is that the case?
I would say that that's true. I mean, their story is really their own to tell in many ways, but understandably, you know, they had really come very, very close to losing their dad once, and losing daily contact with him was really hard for them to take. And I completely understand why. And it was a difficult time. Like, they were both teenagers. My younger was 12, but almost a teenager. And it, you know, they were unhappy with me for sure. And we had conflict around it. And it was a real, real double-edged sword for me, really, really difficult because quite honestly, you know, they and their reaction was my biggest fear
around leaving the marriage, but it was also a big motivation because I did not want them to see, you know, the distance and the difficulties in our marriage as all that a relationship could be. You know, we were poor at resolving conflict, and I bear a huge portion of the blame for that. We were poor at communicating. I was poor at communicating my needs. And I didn't want them to grow up and be in a marriage where that was all there was.
Well, that's all the more reason, because of their feelings when you first were getting divorced, to see how it's like your book has a happy ending in many ways, Kate, that your daughters came around to enjoying your companionship, if I want to put it that way.
I hope so. And I think we're forging a nice relationship. You know, it's now almost 4 years on from the time period that we were writing about, that I was writing about in the book. So one of them is entering her senior year of college and the other is entering her senior year of high school in the fall. So they've grown up. I've changed, grown up, done more therapy, done more, tried to do more healing and be a better, happier, more present parent and person.
For example, when you were first married, you were in the Bay Area and your husband got a job in Sacramento. So you quit your dream job as food editor down there to move with your husband to Sacramento. And so in many ways, you had been sacrificing your desires and your needs all along. And so your book, I think, would inspire women to say, hey, am I doing that? Maybe I should reevaluate. Maybe I should come up with a project like 50 swims.
if this book motivates, you know, people to find what brings them joy and kind of bring them back to themselves, whether it's women or men or anyone, I'll be really happy with it. And, you know, I like what you said about the book does. I hope the book does feel like it has a happy ending. You know, my first book about caregiving was about a very grim landscape for, you know, family caregivers and the ill that, like, was really challenging for me and caused burnout for me and does for millions and millions of families. And it had a lot of very tough material. And this book also has a lot of tough, sad material. You know, there's yeah. grief, there's loss, there's anger. There's challenge, but for me, this book is a much happier book, and I wanted it to feel more joyful. It's not necessarily a self-help or a book of inspiration, but I hope it feels somewhat inspirational because for me, it's the story of how I pulled myself out of long-standing grief and burnout. Like, I think I never really stopped even to properly grieve and mourn my mother and work through some of the pain around that because another crisis came and I was so overwhelmed with that crisis. And so, you know, while there is material that's sad and was, you know, in many ways hard to revisit, a lot of this book is about how I was able to shift my life away from just that feeling of pain and challenge and to incorporate more joy and fun and play, which I think are all things that we all need at any age.
On that note, I would like to thank you for giving us your message. My guest has been Kate Washington. Her book is Midstream, A Life Remade in 50 Swims.
Thank you so much.
And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Love. Love is like the wind, unseen but felt. Love at first is like a gale, blowing us over, tearing at our clothes, feet unsure of where the ground is, sand in our eyes, blurring our vision of what is real or unreal. Exhilarating, exciting, frightening, our hearts pounding, hard to catch our breath. We hold on for dear life and beg for more. Love ever slowly moves into a spring wind, strong but not as strong, ruffling up our hair, sending a warmth into our hearts that flows to every cell of our being. We glow with the heat of love. In the wind, we hear whisperings of new possibilities, adventures into unknown places we dream of and desire. We want to bottle it, hold it close, so we never lose it. Then a stillness comes. No wind is blowing. The air is stagnant, bearing down on us. Our hearts are heavy, the bottle empty. Has love forsaken us, we ask? Then a gentle caress of the cheek, soft words in our ears, the wind picks up. Not lost, but found again. Familiar, but a new wind. Strong, but different. New adventures, new possibilities beckon us. We leap together into this new unknown, again and again and again. By Kathy Lillibridge.
A walk down school road. Temperature is rising. I take a walk down school road. I strip myself of the images projected, attempting to enter the more primitive realm, where there is no plastic, there are no stores, there is no television, there aren't any attitudes, fake smiles, car salesmen, the latest electronic gadget sold to help you, but really meant to remove the authentic parts of you. I hit pavement to feel the heat rise from the earth. But that wasn't enough. So I walked in the dirt, on the shoulder, the discarded parts, the parts forgotten and real, the parts where other men hadn't trodden down and used. This is my sad and pathetic attempt at freedom, if the term even applies. This is where we are at this point in time. But it's far worse than this, because I've forgotten you, and you've forgotten me, and I've forgotten me, and I can't tell who we are. V.P. Bodrix.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.